Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a boogie woogie thing. I'm pegging in the town. I ain't no more good from my hips on down, but I can boogie woogie.
Do that boogie woogie.
Everybody's doing that boogie woogie now. Oh, Sister Lou, she's got a watch and a chain. The way she boogie woogie is a low down shame. I love to see her boogie woogie. Everybody's doing that boogie woogie
fiction. Yvonne Mason is back with a brand new book, The Pink Canary, a book that delves into the life of a drag queen and a marvelous whodunit. You can find this and all of Yvonne's other works on Amazon.com or find Yvonne Mason on Facebook and Twitter.
You're gonna kill me.
Buy your copy of Pink Canary now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. This is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason. And the song that was played at our opening was by a gentleman by the name of Vern Mitten. I had heard that song years and years and years ago, didn't know who made it, who even wrote it, or who even sang it. And my guest tonight helped to bring that to light. I am working on getting Vern on my show with some more of his music. If you liked his music, go to YouTube and pull up Vern Mitten and listen to that song and several more that are sitting up there. He is an old-time country western star, and his music is absolutely over the top. I just love it. The second part of the opening was yet another shameless self-promotion by my ad man and good friend Christopher Dunham, and it was for my book Pink Canary, which is a comedy suspense. Now, Chris has his own radio show, and he also is my ad man, and he can be your ad man. If you're looking for an ad, and every author needs a good ad person to do a 30-second ad, because I'm going to tell you they work. Since he's been doing my ads, I've seen a jump in my book sales because this show's heard all over the world. And he makes them very, very interesting. So go on my Facebook page and look him up, Christopher Dunham. Friend him, tell him that I sent you to him. And he also, if he does an ad for you, might even play it on his show, which is, ta-da, great exposure for you. And we're all about exposure. And I don't mean indecent. I mean good exposure for your art, your craft, your passion, your business. Tonight, I have the honor and the privilege of talking to an author by the name of Glenn Stripling. And for years, Glenn had a story that he wanted to tell about an individual who was tormented with a desire to hurt other people. But when this man acts out this urge, he manages to destroy himself in the process, which is what we all do in some shape or form when we attempt to harm others. So Glenn had this idea. Why not tell the story on another planet set in the future? Sounded good. He wanted to make the tale real with wormholes and fast starships and black holes and I don't know what all. But he did not want to rely on the things alone to tell that story. He wanted his characters to deal with true-to-life situations and talk to one another instead of an audience. Well, Glenn's from Mississippi, and I understand Southern because I'm from Georgia. So his early manuscript had a lot of Southern in it. Now, I don't know why people that read the book told him not to let the book be too Southern, because personally, I think it would have given it an interesting twist. Apparently, these folks told him that people in the future would not be speaking like people in rural Southern America or eating grits and biscuits. Now, why wouldn't they? Who says they wouldn't? But that's another story. So, naturally, that was a very tough decision for Glenn because he has a bit of satire on the many facets of American life, including some of the dark features of our Southern heritage. So, and he also didn't want to let people like me from the South down, but he said some truths are universal and should transcend the many cultures of our planet. Now, already this book has made me want to read it, and I don't like sci-fi, but I bet I'll wind up reading this one. So, without further ado, welcome my Southern friend, Glenn Stripling. How
good
are
evening,
you?
Good evening, I'm sorry.
Yes, that's okay. How are you tonight?
I'm doing good. Thanks for the intro, and it's an honor to be on your show. I've heard a number of your shows already, and they are a blast. You're a hoot, and it's so fun to be here.
Well, you know, that's why we call it Off the Chain, because most nights I have absolutely no idea where this show is going to go. Like I told you before the show, yeah, the show is not scripted. I have notes, but sometimes the notes just get thrown out the window because my guest and I just go off on some tangents, and before we know it, the hour's completely gone. But before we lose the hour, let's talk about Glenn. Now, I find this intro very interesting because, personally, I could see a true Southerner in the future in outer space with grits and gravy. So, before we get into that, though, how did you get interested in sci-fi? How did you get here? What was your upbringing? What brought you to this place?
Well, the whole story, I've always liked to write stories. When I was, you know, in first grade, my teacher would give us an assignment, and arithmetic assignment and trying to write a story, and she told me to do the arithmetic first. I would write the story first, and she would get mad and yell at me. And I'm only 6 years old. I don't like it at all. So I used to fantasize about making robots and shooting her with lightning bolts and killing her. And of I just grew up being, you know, kind of like this, you know, the sci-fi nerd. That, you know, even in school, you know, I guess I got kidded about it a lot. I had trouble, but, you know, I had a little bit of trouble fitting in, not only with my classmates, but with my, even some of my teachers. You know, when I was in high school, I had a baseball coach who ran a study hall, which was a very strange kind of study hall. We would throw chalk and pencils and crayons at each other. And every day the, you know, the baseball coach come in and he would have a couple of my classmates that were also baseball players. And they would come in to sit at the desk, sit around his desk, and they would talk about baseball and cool stuff and sports and, you know, all the great guys would talk about. And what he would do is he would give me an assignment. He would have me sit on this little platform by the window, which is, you know, it's like a floor-to-ceiling window. And he told me when our headmaster, a guy named Mr. Hicks, would walk down the sidewalk, I was supposed to say, Mr. Hicks is coming, and that way the baseball players could run to their desk, and he would get at his desk, and everybody would make out like they're doing work, you know, so nobody would get in trouble. Well, you know, I would sit at this window day after day, and I would sit there and fall asleep. Mr. Hicks would walk by, and I wouldn't see him, and the coach would get, you know, kind of irritated. He said, Glenn, you were supposed to tell us when Mr. Hicks was coming. And I wanted to tell this guy, I said, look, you know, I didn't exactly ask for this job that you gave me. But I found a way to get back at him, sort of. That study hall was like on one side of the football field, and I was that's in the lower school, but was on the other side of the football field. And the upper school had a library, and it was a day that the Space Shuttle Enterprise was going to launch for the very first space shuttle mission. Of course, I was really excited about all that. So it would happen in the morning with just a few, 15, 20, I don't know how many minutes after the study hall started. So he actually took the trouble to walk all the way from the lower school all the way down the sidewalk to the other side of the football field into the library, and he says, Glenn, you're supposed to be in study hall. And, of course, I went in my routine and says, I'm sorry, I wasn't, we're watching the time and all this. And so I followed him back, and he says, you know, Glenn, class started about 20 minutes ago. And he walked, I finally was fine. We didn't say anything to each other. We walked in the study hall, and since then, you know, nobody was, nothing was said about it. But so that's how I had trouble, you know, fitting in. But when I was in seventh grade, I would read some of the really great guys like Asimov, Robert Heinlein. I thought, look, you know, I think I could do some of this stuff. And one time I had a time, I was a weird kid. You know, while my classmates were dreaming about girls, I actually dreamed that I married a Martian princess. And,
wow.
And I was like, well, you know, and one time I had a nightmare about this machine that comes from outer space, crashes in a supermarket in Houston and just sends rays and kills people and all that kind of stuff. It didn't make any sense at all, but I'm like, wow, this is a really cool story. I mean, Robert Louis Stevenson came up with Jekyll and Hyde from a nightmare that he had. I said, this could be a really cool story. And I wrote about two or three chapters of it, and then I quit. But over the years, I started you know, reading books and checking out books to find out how to write novels. I took a course from the Institute of Children's Literature. I dabbled in children's literature after I graduated from college. And then I started writing a play as, you know, kind of a hobby. And then my sister-in-law got me a copy of On Writing by Stephen King. That helped me out a good bit. And by then, you know, years came when my wife was in Wisconsin, you know, there was nothing to do for me. Milwaukee gets pretty cold in March, so I just sat around. I started writing. That's when I first came up with Kenosha. So
now, you told me before the show that you didn't know what Kenosha was when you came up with the name. Before you explain what it was, what made you come up with that name?
Okay, Chrono, you know, the Greeks have a very, you know, very specific kind of language. They have like 14 words for each one of our words. Okay, that's an exaggeration, but to them, there's a difference between the time is 3 o'clock and the time it's time for you to grow up, you know, that kind of thing. So chrono is where we get the word chronometer. It's a time measuring device. So my planet is going to a time reversed universe. So that's why I call the planet Kenosha.
But
but 2 or 3 years later, after it was published, I found out that Kenosha was one of the Greek pagan gods of lust or sexual desire. I thought, okay, I didn't quite make it that way, but it's already been published.
Well, it could have been a subliminal thing because you thought you wanted to grow up and marry a Martian princess. I believe that things happen for a reason, so there's that thread.
Okay, well, that's a way to look at it.
That makes perfect sense to me. To me, that is logical. That is too funny, Glenn. I have heard of interesting titles before, but that one takes the cake, I'm going to tell you. That's absolutely amazing. So in coming up with this title, now you have this title. I know being the probably OCD person that you are, because I know I am, that even though you were writing a science fiction and it was something that you made up, you wanted it to be believable, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So in order for it to be believable, you had to do a little bit of research, at least a little bit. Would that be a true statement?
Yes, research for about a year or so. You know, I've read books by a little bit of Stephen Hawking, but I read the whole shebang, Kip Thorne's, some of the, you know, I couldn't understand the mathematics too well, but you know, I showed a manuscript to the a man who was at the time worked at the Jackson Planetarium. You know, he was I've attended a few of his astronomy classes, so I knew he was talking about it. He gave me some ideas and things to look out for, and then I sent a copy down to a gentleman named Dr. Lawrence Mead at the University of Southern Mississippi, and we corresponded back, and he analyzed it for me. He said, you know, I'm pretty much on the right track, and it was him who came up with the idea of having more women on the starship, because you know that he says, Glenn, you've got to have a woman in the crew because this is going to be in the future, and then there's going to be equality by then. I said, well, okay. So that's how I came up with the character of Sandy.
That is very interesting because for a scientist now. From what I understand, Dr. Mead is an astronomy professor at the University of Southern Mississippi. So
yes, ma'am.
This is a man that is probably extremely learned and knowledgeable in his field.
I never met him.
No, yeah. But what I find interesting and what people don't know that want to write but are afraid to step into that arena because of fear of failure is the worst that someone can tell you is, no, I don't have time to deal with you. But more times than not, people like Dr. Mead and my friend, the FBI agent that helped me with my book, and I only bring it up because they both blend, they're more than willing to share their knowledge and wisdom with us when we start out. And I found that fascinating, that this professor of astronomy, he not only said, you're on the right track, but he said, think of the future and add a third dimension of a female on the spaceship.
Yes, ma'am. What I found intriguing, you know, is like, you know, I do, you know, writing in and I know very little about, you know, anything else, but it's the effect is similar, like to you know, when Tom Sawyer got all of his friends to whitewash the fence and help him out, and everybody just wanted to participate. It's kind of like that, because, you know, there was a whole bunch of people that I could consult and ask questions when I didn't know what I was doing or how to market or. And my illustrator, Lynette Cook, she gave me, you know, a lot of advice on copyright infringement and that kind of stuff. And a good friend of ours, Mary Hootzel, was the lady that, you know, helped maintain the computer with me while I was typing it. And so I put her in the acknowledgement. And when I gave her a copy, she's living at a nursing home at the time, so she went all nursing home and says, look at this book, look at this book, I'm in this book.
And people appreciate that. They really do.
Yes, ma'am.
What I also found interesting, Glenn, is you had to find a way for your killer to travel backwards in time. How
yes,
in
ma'am.
The world that, how did you do that? What mode of transportation or whatever did you do to get him to go back into time?
Well, you know, as I understand why Albert Einstein's equations, you know, they do not prohibit time travel. It's you know, with one time going one way in one realm and then time going forward in another realm. And it doesn't prohibit that. But one thing I was kind of concerned with, you know, is about maybe about 40 years ago, there's a theory in vogue that positrons, positively charged electrons, you know, the electrons of antimatter, they travel like opposite paths. So, you know, some folks have started believing that positrons are just electrons that are traveling backwards in time. And I said, you know, okay, but that's one of the reasons why I contacted Dr. Mead. I said, well, I don't want to send this character into a universe that's made of antimatter. He'll get killed. And he looked over and he says, you know, people really don't believe this theory of positrons going backwards in time anymore. So he told me, don't worry about that. But he told me other things to look out for. He came up with the idea of Alcibiade warp drive. Alcibiade was a Mexican scientist, really smart guy, that came up with the idea that, okay, if a spaceship can't travel through light, but it can, if it has exotic matter, it could create its own space-time bubble, and that's how you can warp your way through. It's a little technical stuff, and to be frank, I'm not sure I understand it myself, but it's a way to get around, you know, the basic law that nothing can exceed the speed of light.
So would it be fair to say that you used a black hole to send this guy back into the past?
Okay. This is what one thing I studied. Kip Thorne is, you know, he was a he was a professor at Caltech. I think he lives in Australia right now. But he came up with the idea that instead of having black holes, he was doing research for Paul Carl Sagan. Instead of having a guy go into a black hole is just a collapsed star with a core that's called a singularity. And it keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller into hyperspace. But he says, okay, what if another black hole somewhere else does the same thing? And it has its singularity. Those two cores that go through hyperspace and annihilate each other, blow each other up. It could create what they call an Einstein-Watson tunnel, which you really can go from one space to the one side of the universe to the other, one time reversal theory. I came up with a time reversal in through a wormhole, but it, as soon as his tunnel forms, it would eventually collapse. So they say one way to get around it is to have exotic matter, which is a type of matter that has negative mass, which means it would have the opposite effect of Newtonian gravity. It's just instead of pulling stuff towards it, it'll push stuff away from it. And you could hold, you could keep the wormhole open that way. And you'll travel back and forth. Dr. Mate, he's of the opinion that there was exotic matter is not possible. So the story, to be frank, is has to be a little bit fanciful. I don't think it's cartoonish, but I think it's part science and part fiction. That's what sci-fi is all about.
That's why it's called science fiction.
Yes, ma'am.
But the detail, because I'm looking over some of the notes that I found that you had written, like Einstein's solution and what little stars are made of, and I'm sure that the detail that you put in this book will just absolutely put someone in that time and space with this guy. You probably catch yourself wanting to jerk the victim away before the victim gets killed, but one minute they're there and the next minute they're gone.
Yes, the way the book, I don't think I'm getting too much away, but the way the book ends, they have my protagonist ends up on the planet at the very end of the book, and he has a chance to stop this guy from committing this killing, but he knows that he can't do that because 75 years have passed, and it will change everything, if he interferes and changes history with this guy.
In fact, I've had this conversation with someone else that was on my show not too long ago, and we were talking about time travel and the fact that, let's say for the sake of this discussion, that time travel is possible.
Okay.
If one goes back or forward into history, one has to be very careful. Because, like you say, one can change the course of history with one small, tiny detail.
Yes, ma'am. I think you're hitting on, what's one of the biggest arguments against time travel, as we as a trade in sci-fi, and that is the grandfather paradox. That is the idea that, if you go back in time and kill your grandfather before he meets your grandmother, your parents will never be born, and you will never be born. And if you're never born, you could not go back in time in the first place. you know, how does all this give? And then a few months ago, I think eSkeptic sent me an email. This guy has come up with his own take, his own book of that. And he said, well, there is a way to resolve the grandfather paradox, and that is you can't time travel in the way that it's portrayed. According to him, yes, I could go back for 1962, when I was born. But one, according to him, one rule of the universe it has to be saying is the conservation of matter, which with Einstein's equation E equals mc squared, energy can be turned to matter, matter can be turned to energy. But the gross amount of matter and energy in the universe has to be the same. So if I go back in the 1960s and see myself as a little boy, I'm adding matter to the universe, meaning, my body. Now, the matter that makes up my body has always been there, but if I go back to yesterday, the food that I ate yesterday, it's not going to be part of my body. And I go back too far in time, it's going to be vegetables hanging from the vine or in a garden or in the ground as nutrients in the soil. And I would just vaporize or disappear because, I can't be adding stuff that makes me. I can't be doubling that.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Yes, ma'am.
Because the same equation, two pieces of matter cannot occupy the same space. So let's say you went back in time. You would literally be occupying the same space as your former self, and you cannot logically do that.
Yeah. One idea that I have thought about, and I kind of wonder if any other scientists or any scientists have thought about it. I'm not a scientist, but the Earth is moving around the sun at 18 miles a second, and the sun is moving around the center of the galaxy, how many times a second? So if you go back like Marty McFly and the DeLorean and go back in 30 years, you're going to a spot that did not, that the Earth was not in 30 years ago. So, what are you going to do? End up in space? So you would have to change a whole lot of the universe to accommodate you. You would have to make the Earth go back to where it was in the past, and you have to make the Earth rotate to the exact spot where you would, be. I mean, that is a pretty tall order.
It is. That would be like trying to recreate an accident scene the next day or 3 days later at a certain time when the sun was at a certain spot in the sky to net the same result of what happened at that accident. It is impossible to do because 3 days later, the direction of the sun at that time of the day is at a different angle.
Yeah, it's go by, by the seasons, yeah.
Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Is it possible, and of course with sci-fi, anything is possible, might be something for you to think about writing, it possible or probable that there might be a parallel universe out there that mirrors what we do in this universe?
Yeah, what's frustrating is there's never no need to, you know, there's no way to verify that or to go by. When I was 6 years old, I did this thought experiment. I looked at the mirror in my living room, and I said, well, there's this kid there that is in a room that looks exactly like me. The room looks like my room. He's doing the same thing ever I'm doing. I was like, could be a real person? And I says, well, I feel like I'm controlling the situation by moving this way or that way. He's doing the same thing, but how do I know that he's doing the same way he's controlling me? And I said, if it was irritating was, I couldn't find a way to disprove that.
It's something to think about, because us in our little finite minds are narcissistic enough to believe that we are indeed the only intelligent creature out there. But just because we can't see it doesn't mean that it isn't possible that there is a parallel universe or even life out there past a wormhole or a black hole or somewhere out there beyond the stars.
Yes, it's, it's the idea of a multiverse, a combination of all universe and all probabilities. According to some, they've entertained the idea. Now, I think with some level of seriousness, that if you're walking down the street or you're driving your car down the road and you see another car and you think, well, I might swerve over and hit this guy. You probably don't do it, but once you make that decision, there's somebody that's like you in another universe that will swerve over and actually hit him. And every decision that you make, you're creating the whole another universe. This will be different from somebody, from your counterpart that's not not doing the same thing that you are. I said, oh, okay, this is crazy, but to me, Dr. Mead told me something very funny. The word universe actually means all that there is.
Uh-huh.
So a multiverse is just a giant universe. I mean, I've heard theories about one theory that all the billions of cubic light years that this known universe is made of, all of that could be inside of an electron orbiting an atom and even in an even bigger universe. I thought, okay, this is getting real hokey, but it's just one of these things that can't be verified.
But neither can it be disproved. Go ahead.
It's one of the problems of string theory. It's there's these people who think, that atoms and all particles, all matter, is made up of strings of energy that are maybe millions of times smaller than atoms. And they vibrate certain this way or that way, and they were able to make matter possible, but they have no way to verify. The only thing that squares with it is mathematics, and that's all that they have. So, there's some folks saying, well, this is not, if it's not verifiable, it's not really science, and it kind of borders on philosophy or something else.
Then how would one explain a sense of deja vu? There could be a couple of ways. One is if one believes in reincarnation, or if one believes or theorizes that it is possible that maybe one came from a parallel universe.
Yes, I believe you have me stumped with this one. I mean that sounds really wild.
It's anything is possible in this universe. I mean, because general rule, humans only think with a third of their brain. I don't know what they do with the other two-thirds, but they only think with a third of their brain. Imagine what could happen if we used the entirety of our brain to reason with. There is nothing that is impossible or improbable.
Well, probably not.
I know I've stumped you, but it's something to think about, Glenn. Because
yes, ma'am.
I've read all of your research on Chronasia, and it makes probable sense to me. I mean, it makes total sense with me. Because Einstein says, or your page where Einstein is, says the speed of light will not change no matter what kind of motion any observer is in. So the speed of light is the speed of light, period. Einstein concluded that this could be true if two impossible things are possible. Time does not flow at the same rate of those who are not in uniform motion with everything else, and the rulers of people not in uniform motion will not be the same length of those who are. So
yes,
go ahead.
At least one of those things has got to be true to come in Einstein's reality. You know, when it came out with in the 1970s, I believe it was, these guys put some atomic clocks. One was on an airplane on the ground, and one was halfway from east to west, or I think to. And after 10 hours or whatever in this jet plane, and they came back and found that the clock that was on the plane ticked at like a few billionths of a second slower than the one that was on the ground. And the change was in such a rate that it matched Einstein's equations perfectly. So, you know, it's validated, but, you know, yes, it is weird. But, like I say, you were asking me about, could there be parallel universes? Well, in our particular universe, you know, things have to be just right before atoms can form together to form, matter. And if the laws of physics were just a little bit different, they would not be able to form. But it could be some universe where the laws are a little bit different. Like, you know, there might be some universe where the speed of light is 30 miles per second. If things were a little bit different, that the universe could be there, but nothing is going to form out of it. And there's some folks, I think Neil deGrasse Tyson talked about this, it could be that we just happen to be lucky that the laws of this particular universe are such that, that everything that is today can be possible.
What I also found interesting in Einstein's solution forces is that it forces us to accept a couple of principles. One, there is no such thing as absolute space. And two, there is no such thing as absolute time. And that is true,
yeah,
because time is not absolute.
Yeah. And let's say so, Einstein lived in a world of passenger trains, so that's where he did a lot of thought experiments. And idea that if you're standing in a rail car and you turn on a flashlight and the light goes to goes to the front of the car, if you're approaching the speed of light, the light from your flashlight has less time to get there. So the logical thing would be your railroad car would have to be shorter. So from an observer, the railroad car would appear to shrink. Now, Einstein did not exactly say this, but this is my interpretation of what he was talking about. And, I think I was corresponding with some fella in England. I've read one of his websites, and I asked him, I said, look, if you're in a spaceship approaching the speed of light, the spaceship explode if it shrinks too much? And he says, no, because it's only going to shrink from the standpoint of an observer. The people inside are going to see everything the same length, and time will pass for the same, in the same way from their point of view as it always does.
Interesting.
Yes, ma'am.
So let's put it in another perspective. I have seen pictures where it looks like someone is holding the sun in a picture or someone is holding the moon in a picture. It's the same principle, right? Speed of light has shrunk that object, but no one is really reaching out to grab the moon.
Yeah.
Same principle.
I'm not quite sure I follow you here, though.
Okay. I have seen photographs where, let's just, for the sake of this conversation, Mary Jane is standing in the foreground, and the sun is in the background, but it looks like she has the sun in her hand. And it's the way that the photograph was either taken or exposed or let's say it was an old film, that the film was exposed and manipulated. But in order to get that picture that way, when that shutter flashed on that camera, the speed of light with which that shutter flashed is what produced it looking like she was holding that sun in her hand.
This is something, you're going to have to ask a photographer, because I think your perspective about this, I know this, this sounds more like an optical illusion kind of thing.
The same premise is with the flashlight. It is an optical illusion, because as you're describing someone in a train car with the flashlight, you only see so far, and it's like an optical illusion that you can see further than you can.
Oh, yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Because you have to walk further to see further with that flashlight.
Right.
Interesting. Where can people find you?
Okay, the best place to find me is on Facebook. I'm under Glenn Stripling. I did have a contact thing on my website. It's clear to me that you've been, exploring everything on my site, and that's really good. You're prepared, that site is several years old now, by the way. And, things go wrong. It changed from, it was set up by Media Shark, and then it was, then Adopted has it. And it's run now by a gentleman named, Mr. Smith. I'll just, you know, I'll tell you, I can't think of his first name right now, but he did a fantastic job. You know, he worked just about all night a couple of nights ago to get a link to the to my anthology, Volume 2. It's what I use for a fundraiser for Bar.
You have a couple of short stories out too, don't you? The Geysers of Ecclesiastes, The Seas of Titan, and Earth Invader Mars, or Earth Invades Mars. Are those Are those available on Amazon?
Some are. My first one was run by I sold to The Earth Invades Mars. I sold that to Shelter Daylight. At the time, it was run by a gentleman named Tyree Campbell and my friend Erica Rayner. And it was Sam Stott Publishing at the time. I think it's Alvin Lake. What happened with Sam Stott, you know, they broke up. There were some people that apparently couldn't get along. I think they had a few nasty problems. So they broke up, but sometimes they worked together. One guy that worked with them was a guy named Jay Irwin. He went to Martian Waver. And I think right now it's Nomadic Delirium Press. But every one of these short stories, you can get it in different ways. Some of them are in print form, some are not. And you know, some have Kindle, and some, the best way is to, log in. I could tell you the websites to each one.
So it would be better if someone just contacted you on Facebook and said, where can I go find these, and you'd tell them.
Okay. Just go to Glenn Stripling, that's me. And, you know, I'll tell you how to link one. But the best way is if you see a story that you like, for example, the Geysers of Enceladus, and click on a search and it'll take you to it, but that particular one is Volume 3, 2012. It's on Smashwords. The Seas of Titan are Nomadic Delirium Press. It's a really easy thing to call. It's www.nomadicdeliriumpress.com/tmw.htm. You can use the same site to get the Volcanoes of Io. That's a 2014 issue. Longa Regio, that's in Marshall. That's in the 2015 issue, but you can get to that on the same address.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you working on something new, or are you working on a new book?
Yes, right now I'm working on a story called The Song of Jupiter. It's a story I guess I kind of made it into a Shakespearean tragedy. I first wanted a short story, and then I'm into it off a novella. I mean, I'm past 10,000 words, so I think I'm going to have a full-blown novel. But it's about a fella who is kind of a Boy Scout, goody-two-shoes fella. He's a real good person with a good heart, but he's accused of murdering a teenage girl, which is a crime that he did not commit. But to avoid prosecution, he has to get on a space liner and fly to Callisto, which is one of the moons of Jupiter. And in the process, he gets involved with narcotics dealers. And, he's a good person, but he has to be a criminal to survive. And his whole life is ruined by this thing that just started by being accused of something that he didn't do.
When is this one coming out?
Well, if you can find a publisher for me that will buy it,
why don't you contact my publisher?
Well, Yvonne, I'm just being a little facetious here. I'm still in the process of typing it right now.
I'll hook you up with her when you're ready, because I'm half owner of that publishing company, so it's a done deal if you want it.
Yes, no, that sounds pretty good. If she likes sci-fi, I don't think she'll be disappointed.
Because we publish just about every genre.
Oh, good. Okay.
So now you got to finish the book, Lynn. Yeah, so now you got to finish the book so you can come back on the show.
Yes, ma'am, but there's some projects, I'm working on too. It's just depending on what I'm going, I decide what to do right now. There's a young lady in St. Petersburg, Florida, that says she might be willing to write a screenplay for me for Chronosia. And I see how much she charged. She can't really get to it till till the summer. She's kind of booked up. In the meantime, I have Chronosia 2, my sequel titled. I had an editor look at it and everything. It's good to go, but I'll have to raise some money to get it self-published. You know, if you're a writer to write and you self-publish things, you got to keep track of it, because it's a good bet that you're going to be spending more money than you're making. So
we'll talk. Not necessarily. Ladies and gentlemen, we are getting to the end of our show, and before we run out of time, our guest tomorrow night is author Anne-Marie Martin. And Glenn,
yes,
it has been a pleasure. It has been an absolute pleasure that you have agreed to spend that hour with me. I think we have totally boondoggled our listening audience with our sci-fi adventures. I think they're scratching their heads and going, I got to go check this out.
I hope so. In fact, I think he helped me make a sale already today, because I was setting up my anthology to raise money for BARC, which is an organization in Minnesota that helps find dog homes for dogs, gives them vaccinations, and finds people to adopt them. So I was proud to help out, but one of the ladies who works for that thing sent me a message today and saying she's interested in buying my book. So that was really sweet. This is what getting the word out does.
It does. And ladies and gentlemen, it costs nothing for you to come on this show. All it costs you is a desire and a willingness to promote the show once I know. So if you have a passion, if you have a book, if you have music, if you have artwork, if you have a business, if you have a platform even, we will be at 10,000 listeners by the end of this year. We are already at 6,700 plus between the live show itself, which we're almost to 3,000, to all of the podcasts. They're all over the world. This show is all over the world. Now, I don't know where else you can go and get that kind of free promotion. You say, well, Yvonne, I've never been on a show before. Neither is half of my guests, but that doesn't matter. Because we have so much fun on this show, you forget you're on live radio. So, Glenn, once again, thank you for being on the show. And, ladies and gentlemen, the world is made of dreamers. Without dreamers, we have no society. Make your dream real. Love yourself. Like yourself. And join us tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. For Off the Chain with our guest, Anne-Marie Martin. Glenn, don't hang up. So until then, good night. Okay, the show is off the air. Oh, what happened to my...
Okay.
The show itself is off the air, but we go in archives, and people that listen to the archives get to listen to this little bit that we talk about. But I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show and spending an hour with me. I appreciate it so, so very much.
Yes, it did seem like an hour. Yeah, I appreciate it. I've been talking with you know, some other people I'm trying to persuade, you know, to join your show, and some of them have stage fright, so like they says, well, you know, I'm not sure if I want to be on the radio. I says, well, there's nothing to it. You know, I just feel like I was just talking on the telephone, which is essentially what I'm doing.
What are they afraid of? I'm not going to eat them for lunch. I might nibble a little bit, but I won't eat them. But it's good exposure for them. You know, there's a anagram for the word fear. It's called false evidence that appears real, and that is what happens. People are afraid of that which they don't know, and the evidence that they work up in their mind appears real, and it's really not real evidence. If they believe in themselves and they believe in their product, then they should have no worries about coming on this show.
Yeah, I guess you figured out that I do have OCD, and it was I had severe anxiety, you know, during my college years. And if I would have done this like in 1982, my heart would have gone on to like 120 beats a minute because my body could not have handled the adrenaline. And I've taken medicine over the years, and I'm a slightly different person.
I put people at ease. It's just a conversation between two people.
Yes, ma'am. And I'm hoping more and more, you know, our friends can figure this out. Yeah, Vernon said he hit it off with you
I have to call him back and once I get the show set. And I don't know where he and his lovely little wife thought it was 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm not even awake good at that time of day. And they call me, and I haven't called them back because I've just been so, so busy. But I'm going to set their show for March once I get all of his music translated to MP3s and get him on the air. And let's see if we can't get people interested in his music again.
Oh, yeah, that'd be so wonderful. He helped me get on WLBT for my interview. You can watch. I put the interview on my Facebook, on my website, and it disappeared for a week. My webmaster put it on back on the other night. So my website, my opening page looks a little bit cluttery right now, but we wanted to have everything good for, you know, ready for your show.
Well, what I'm going to do when we get off from here, And I shut down the show itself, it will archive. And once it gets through archiving, I will put it up on my page and tag you in it. Well, when I tag you in it, you can take that show and put it on your website. Also, when I upload the podcast to the different podcasts that I have, I will put the link on my page and tag you in it, and your webmaster can take that link and put those podcasts on your website too. So this show will be at anybody's fingertips that wants to go and listen to it.
Yeah, one thing we're puzzled about, you know, I tried getting this show on my computer so my wife could listen, but I put a link that went to your site with a picture of me and my book. But we couldn't get it to do anything. But you're saying once it goes into archive, and we'll be able to read it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it shouldn't take – the other night it took all night for it to, but that was something wrong with the server itself. But it should take about 20, 30 minutes for it to go up. As soon as it goes up, I'll put it up on the page and link you, and then you go in there and just click on it and listen to it.
Okay.
All right. Well,
yes, ma'am.
I will.
And
go ahead.
If I decide to come out with Chronoja 2 or my next story or have a screenplay made, I'll contact you. Maybe we can talk about that. It's got to be something exciting. But I'm going to be in a movie this coming February. Same kind of difference as me. I'm going to be an extra. Saying I saw the trailer for it first tonight.
See, we didn't even talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't even mention that to you. I was, we got rambling, but that's okay.
Well, we'll have to remember. Well, the people that are listening to the show in archives will know that you're going to be in a movie. What's the name of the movie?
The same kind of different as me. It's going to be in theaters like February 3rd.
Nice. Well done. Very well done.
I'm in the they filmed the funeral scene in Jackson. I'm in the funeral scene. You probably won't see me because it's just a church full of people. But I just sat there and I'll be quiet and listen to the guy talk. I couldn't hear him say anything, and I got paid for it too.
Hey, there you go. That's all that counts.
Well, I'm
going to get off from here, my friend, and get this show archived and get it up on my Facebook page and tag you in it so that you can go in and listen to it. And thank you again for being on my show.
Thank you. Love you, and I had a good time.
Thank you, sweetheart. Talk later.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Good night.